Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always by my good friends and partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. And boys, we have a very special treat today on the air, on the program. I'm actually in my classroom. So imagine the guy from Dead Poets Society, just kind of walking around on the tables, making the education happen. I'm here in my classroom with my intro to podcasting class. So you guys say hello to our audience, okay?
Hello.
There they are, eager Christian college students, all of them perfect, all of them ready to learn. And today is going to be a fun episode because we're just going to let them lob questions at us, questions about podcasting, questions about just the bright lights of this business, boys, and what it feels like to be kind of in this rarefied space as an evangelical superstar, you know, not to put too fine a point on it. But before we get into all that, I want to talk about my favorite coffee brand, my favorite coffee to drink, the only coffee that I drink, is produced right here in Jackson, Tennessee by one Hector Lagares. Hector Lagares is a local coffee roaster. He's also very authentic in that he flies often to Honduras and Nicaragua and walks through the groves and examines each coffee bean before it gets roasted. And you need to visit LagaresRoasters.com, buy a bag of the Happy Rant signature blend. It will be the best coffee you've ever tasted. So again, LagaresRoasters.com, Happy Rant signature blends, and tip of the knitted hipster beanie to one Hector Lagares. Ron, how are you? It took us a little while to connect, but I haven't heard your voice in a while, baby. I just want to hear it.
Baby, I'm good. I'm good. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be here with your students. And I just had some connection issues, and that's how it goes sometimes.
Baby, I can tell by the quality of your Wi-Fi or lack thereof that you're at home in Ashland. So my condolences that that you're back home. How is that going?
I mean, I'm home in Ashland. I'm at the church, which allegedly has better Wi-Fi, but apparently not.
Baby, when does the conference circuit ramp back up for you again? Like, when can we have you back out on the road? What is that looking like?
Yeah, I mean, there's some downtime right now, probably March.
Okay.
So just give me a, enjoy the next month and a half of me being, in Ashland and having bad Wi-Fi.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I got you, baby. I got you. Now, when is normal pastors?
That's not till the summer, August.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And did we get you a little plenary? Are you on the main stage for that?
I think that's all there is.
Yeah?
So, yeah. Yeah.
Piper, would you look at that? Our boy is all grown up. He's got his own plenary sesh.
I like how he played it cool that he didn't know exactly what day and time he's speaking.
I don't know, maybe
summer, liar. You know,
exactly.
you know the date, you know the time.
Kansas City and hope to run into it.
Yeah. No. I mean, I'll find the date. I don't have it on me. I don't know the exact date.
Baby,
you have it tattooed on you, Ron. I feel like you're not being totally truthful right now.
Baby, you have a window open on your laptop and a Google search.
Why are you always questioning my sincerity? where did this come from?
I have no idea. We must have just made it up, Piper.
All of a sudden, I just became the great liar.
Baby, you're not the great liar.
I mean, this is America. Like, there's a few more
nice
of those
guy
around
on the broadcast, and now he's like, "No, Ronnie's the liar. He's just a liar now."
You're the local man of the cloth, as well as the untrustworthy one. I think that's how we've
local man of the cloth traveling.
Those two things probably go hand in hand: a man of the cloth and the greatest liar.
I mean, that does seem to be in the water these days.
Oh boy. Oh,
baby, are you walking a little taller now that you've booked normal pastors? Is Big M looking at you a little differently around the house?
No, I don't think so. I think she has some higher aspirations.
Oh, she does. She's right, like, I'm not going to let you be satisfied with that, Jared.
Right. It's like last time I checked, you're not going on at TGC after like Crawford LaRitz. So we'll talk, man.
That's right. Well, you know what? That's iron sharpening iron in the Martin household, and she's calling you to a higher standard. But speaking of a higher standard, I have students in the room. They are eager to lob questions at us and see how this Happy Rant magic comes together on a week-by-week basis. So I'm going to open it up to the floor. And you guys, Ron, you probably know this because you've led breakout sessions at many conferences. Sometimes there's a little lull or a little awkward silence before the first question. So
absolutely.
Bear with the group.
A little hesitancy, Big T.
A little hesitancy, baby. And in this business, in the education business, You know, you just got to power through that. So, so I'm going to open it up to the group. Who has a question for Barnabas, Ron, or myself?
Should I ask my weird question?
Yeah, Tam, there's no weird questions.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, fire away, please.
Okay. So, this is something I came up with a little earlier today. Mm-hmm. So, if you were stuck on a deserted island,
okay,
which one of your Happy Rant merch would you pick?
Okay.
For survival and why?
For survival and why. So the question is, and Tam is a just an excellent student in that she's already seamlessly marketing for our Missionalware products. So if you haven't done so already, listening audience, visit missionalware.com. You can access any of these products for your own desert island trip. So the question is, of all of our merch, so the Moleskine journals, the like toddler size Yeti tumbler with our logo on it, the T-shirts, the long sleeve tees, which one would you take to a desert island and why? So let's start with a marketing guru on the podcast. Let's start with one Barnabas Piper. Pipe, fire away.
Well, I think if it's a desert island, I think any of the apparel is out because you don't really need that much. That's you just get a nice tan.
Happy Rant sunscreen.
Yeah, that seems unnecessary. The Moleskine would be useful for like a fire starter. You know, you got to get that first fire started. After that, you can keep it. You kind of keep it going for signal fire, for cooking. I don't know if there's anything on this desert island to cook, but that's a possibility. The Yeti tumbler is. You can't do a lot with that. It's just sort of a metal container. So
besides hold water and keep it cold, I feel like that would be useful on a desert island.
But yeah, I mean, if there's no water, you're not going to last long anyway. So that's true. If there's water, that could be useful. I'm kind of inclined towards the pint glass, though.
Okay.
I feel like you could break off the top part of it, and then you'd have like a sharp object that you could use for cutting. You know, you'd have like a large shard of glass, and then the bottom part, if you didn't shatter it completely, that then becomes like a small drinking glass. So I think I'm going to go with the pint glass out of all of the things that we offer. I think that would be most useful on a desert island.
There you go. That's Barnabas Piper going very literal. on all of our that's good though. I mean, that's really
I
good.
Also
that's,
had to list through as many products as I could think of in that, because that's how good promotions work.
That's like a one long promo read right there. Right. Ron, what about you? You're in a desert island scenario. You can bring along only one ancillary Happy Rant product. What's it going to be?
Yeah, I mean, by the way, Pipe, that was well articulated. I think I'd have to go with the Moleskine, right? I mean, I gotta journal my thoughts, and I gotta be able to get some words down. So I'll have to find a way to do that, because nobody said that, because we don't have any Happy Rant pens or pencils, do we?
I don't think we do, but we need that. So
yeah,
pen and pencil industry, if you're listening, have your
so
people.
Somehow I have to like carve some magic like chalk somewhere on the island so that
you
I can start
have
like
a pencil in your
stuff.
Pocket. Let's say you got one in your pocket.
Oh, like, then it's a no brainer. Yeah, I would just take the Moleskine and I would write really tiny print so that all the years I was there, I could fill it all up and still have room to spare.
Baby, do you think that you and I, after we get off the island, could get another like together book deal to publish our Moleskine?
I mean, is that even a question? I mean, do you think that maybe Zondo would want to put something like that out, baby?
Not Zondo. No, we're 0 for our lives with Zondervan. But I think we could get another publishing house to put that out, and there may be another trip to Toledo in it for us.
Yeah, finding God on the island.
Finding God on the island. I love it. I've already got a prop together, baby.
Is it already done? Did you already send it to Wolves? Are we good?
I already sent it to Wolves. Good. So the Moleskine. For Big R, for me, boys, gosh, I don't know. I feel like you guys are more – Piper would definitely be, like, the most resourceful. Like, did you guys watch Lost? Did you ever watch the show Lost?
Of course.
I did. Yeah. I was never a Lost guy. I watched 24 instead. I realized that it wasn't an either-or, but that was my viewing pleasure in those
days. No, I get it. Back then, there kind of was an either-or, I think, with those two shows, but – Piper or Ron, which Lost character do you think Piper would be? I think he would be like the main guy. Don't you think?
The guy. Yeah, I think that's good. Doctor. Yeah. What's his name? Yeah, Jack. The dude from Party of Five or whatever.
Yeah, that guy.
Jack.
He'd be Jack. Jack's like getting stuff done, being super resourceful. I don't know which guy I would be, but I wouldn't be that.
Isn't there like a weird prophetic old guy?
Yeah, there's a couple of those guys.
Yeah.
I feel John. Like that you might have potential for that, Ted.
I'd be weird, prophetic, old guy.
I mean, I think you could pull it off.
Yeah, I can live with that. I'll take that. So in that vein, I think I would go with the Happy Rant long sleeve tee.
Yeah.
It's one of the favorite products of ours that that I have. It fits really nicely. The arms stay really long, like they don't shrink in the laundry. I just like it.
Is that a problem on desert islands, shrinking in laundry?
I feel like if I do the laundry like in the river or whatever, it'll retain its shape, and you know, it's nice and long. So it's just a good long sleeve tee. So so check that out at missionaware.com. Also, I may bring some Happy Rant Lagares Roasters coffee. You know, if I got to be on this deserted island, I need some coffee. So I'm bringing some of that along too. So two products for me. Other questions, class. Other product placement questions. It doesn't have to be product placement.
I have another weird question.
Yeah, lay it on us.
Okay. So this is random.
Yeah.
But out of you three, mm-hmm. Okay. This is during a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
Who would be...
Fun topic.
This is a very cataclysmic podcast so far.
It's very fun, very chill.
Okay. Tamara, keep in mind that Ronnie travels roughly every 4 days.
Oh, so me too.
The desert island.
This could happen. Yeah, this could happen.
The pre-desert island question.
Okay.
So during the plane crash,
yep.
Who is the pilot, who Ooh. Is the flight attendant, and who is the scared passenger?
Pilot, flight attendant, and scared passenger. Out of the three of us, who is which role?
Wow.
Yeah, Big R, you've got a pretty good read on these things. You're a resident man.
Oh, dude.
and then provide the Enneagram numbers to go with those.
Of course,
absolutely. What are we, savages? I mean, we are. After we're
that's,
on the
that's a given. Sorry, I guess I didn't need to say that. My bad, y'all.
I mean, you ask any of us and we're all going to like think that we're the guy that should be the pilot, right? So it's like I feel like there's no getting around that.
The pilot's the one that crashed the plane. I don't want that on my conscience.
That's fair.
I don't want that kind of responsibility.
But to be fair, we would all lie and say somebody else should be the pilot because that's the thing we're supposed to do.
That's true.
Yeah. I don't really see myself as the steward, you know? I see myself as either the pilot or the scared dude.
Yeah.
I see, you know, Ted, I'm going to be honest, baby. I hope this doesn't offend you, man. But I see you in that moment as being a little more steward-like, where you're going to look at me and pipe, and you're going to be like, boys, how can I help?
Baby, I literally was going to say the same thing. Like, I've always kind of seen myself in that steward role. Yeah, yeah.
Like somehow, this is what I mean. You're going to make peace real fast with our impending doom.
And you're going to be like... Peace.
Yeah, you're going to be like, how can I help you guys? Like, you know, the Lord's going to save us. We're all going to be face to face, you know, know him as we've been known here, glass darkly, all that stuff, like in a matter of minutes. Like, you're going to be like preaching scripture to us, like everything's good. And then, I don't know, me and Pipe are going to be trading spots on either being like pilot scared guy.
Yeah, I think I see Piper like up in the cockpit. He's taking the wheel. He's trying to land that plane, you know. And tip of the cap to him for that. Tip of my steward's cap to Piper for trying to save all of our
lives. Tip of the pilot's hat back. Thank you.
Exactly. Yeah. Piper's going to get over he'll get over that intercom on the plane and be like, wow, we're experiencing a little bit of turbulence.
ladies and gentlemen, don't mind the smoke out of the window on the left side of the plane.
That kind exactly.
Of thing. Yeah,
exactly. Ron will be texting at Jared C. Wilson saying that he won't be able to make it to Normal Pastors in August. Cancel all my conference bookings. Doggone it. Yeah, I think I think that's pretty accurate. You know, I see Piper flying the plane. I see Ron and I kind of being stewards / scared guys.
But. Now, is it my fault that the plane is going down, or was there like engine failure? I'm not sure how comfortable. Okay, in that case, I'm okay with this. I'm not totally comfortable taking the blame for everybody's impending doom. Although Ted, you're handling it wonderfully.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. Tam, did you have a follow-up question?
Not a question, but basically the pilot question there was, the pilot actually like fainted or passed out or something, so one of you guys jumped
in.
Oh,
so you're taking over.
Yeah.
Dude, in that case, so I don't know if you guys know this, my old man was a pilot.
In that case, I want Ted to be the one who jumps up in the cockpit because I don't have any idea what I'm doing, and you might.
I feel like I got most of my dad's bad qualities, but maybe if I got a couple of his good qualities, it may include like being able to land a plane. But
genetic.
Yeah, I've been on a lot of plane rides with Pops. I feel like I've watched him like doing his job enough that I could maybe I could get us to the ground. You know, I could.
We're gonna get to the ground
either way, Chester. You know, it's just how fast it happens.
Between you and gravity, we're gonna get to the ground.
That's right. Somehow, some way, we're gonna work this thing out. Tam, that's a good question. Thank you for that. Yeah, no, it's always enjoyable to, you know, as much as we travel as media moguls, you know, we could very well run into this scenario at some point.
So you have to know.
We do have to know. Yeah, we could be on a trip to like. Sign our next big merchandising contract with Missionalware down in Florida in Jeff's mom's basement. And, you know, and all this could go down in route. So, yeah, thanks for putting that in front of us. Lots to chew on. Other questions about plane crashes or not plane crash related?
Yeah, let's go away from things that involve us potentially dying.
You know what?
not to hinder anyone's creativity.
Okay, Chester, you've got one more death-related question. Lay it on us.
We'll say it's not on an island because we've already done that, but let's say it's kind of this secluded location.
Uh-huh.
No Hunger Games style.
Oh, no.
That includes death.
Oh, wow. I have a very morbid group. This is like...
Wait, is this like going to go into, if we were all playing Hunger Games, which of us would be the last man standing? Was that the question?
That was the question. Yeah. These kids are so morbid. This is like doing a podcast with like a... early 2000s like group of emo high school kids, you know, like
I feel like there's a lot of like would you rather games being played in the dorms at Union these days or something.
Dude, I think there are, but so the question is, in a Hunger Games scenario, which one of us is coming off the island, like, so who's the last man standing?
Doesn't even have to be death, just who gets incapacitated, who's the last one standing.
Oh, good. Chester, I appreciate that. That's very sweet. Very sweet.
That's
of you
not
to put
how
that
the Hunger Games work, Chester.
Yeah. That's the union approved Hunger Games. You're not dying, you're just incapacitated, and there's no nudity.
Yeah, no nudity or alcohol in this Hunger Games. And
no nudity,
and
no
only
alcohol
maiming.
In this Hunger Games. No killing.
No dancing.
Sure, you know. Yeah, no dancing. Nobody's dancing their way off the island. There's no dance fighting, so that can't be a thing. I don't know, man. This is a tough one. Piper, do you have thoughts on this? And hear me when I say I don't like to think of you guys in this context. I don't want to be fighting you two.
All right. So if we were going to list the advantages for each of us, Ted is a former boxer. That's a significant advantage over Ron and myself, who I don't believe I'm leaving anything out of Ron's biography to say that he and I are not trained fighters in any way.
Correct. Correct.
So that is an advantage. I'm a few years younger, which means I might be more spry than these guys in terms of like just recoverability after taking a beating from Ted.
Piper, I'm going to say I like you in a foot race, though. Like, if we had to run off the island, I think you would beat Ron and myself.
So, yeah, basically I just run until you guys are tired and then, like, hit you with something heavy just to maim you. Again, no killing. So, Ron, what are your advantages?
Dude, I don't...
Defend yourself in this scenario.
I'm dead.
I'm dead.
You needed somebody to like step up and be like, I volunteer.
I feel like Ron would have, he would have the fewest calories to burn off, Piper, because he's always dieting. And,
that's true. Like, if this was a long term thing, he is more used to living on next to no food than either of us. We would be severely like that would be severe hardship for us.
Dude,
for Ron,
would,
he's
Ron
like
could subsist on like the nuts and berries and.
I do. If I could just find some nuts and berries, and I could find
a
good
hipster feast,
place,
baby.
I mean, I could last for a long, long time.
So. Needs to be a
long-term
conflict.
He's playing the long game.
Yeah.
Ron's playing the long game. He's like Katniss Everdeen in the Hunger Games, and that he's going to hide in the tree for a few days, you know? He's going to eat the leaves and you know, come up with a plan for a bistro to open in Ashland after he gets back. You know, call it Hunger Games the Bistro. And
maybe I'll open it on the island, baby.
Maybe you could open it on the island. Pipe and I could visit and talk about how there's nothing on the menu that
That's
we
right.
like.
We still won't eat this stuff.
Exactly. Well, you know what? Maybe I think we've come up with compelling arguments why all three of us could win. If it comes down to fighting, I win. If it comes down to running, Piper wins. And if it comes down to, like, subsisting on, like, hipster twigs and berries, then Ron wins. So I think, you know, way to keep
it. I feel so affirmed.
It's kind of exactly. It's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure, really.
It is. It's like that new movie on Netflix, which I'm blanking on the name of.
Bandersnatch.
Bandersnatch. Yeah. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah, it freaked me out.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't realize it was interactive. And
yeah.
The controller just starts shaking on the desk.
Dude, that's crazy.
What?
Interesting. I got to watch that. What's the other like big Netflix thing that just dropped with Sandy Bullock in it?
Bird Box.
Bird Box. Was that good?
No.
Depends on who you ask.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen The Happening?
I haven't.
That movie basically came out like 10 years ago. Basically, people were just...
It's an M. Night movie, baby.
Oh, is it an M. Night Shyamalan movie?
Yep. Yeah, it's like his worst vehicle of all time.
Oh, no.
Wow. Oof, that's rough, especially for
dude,
him.
It's Mark Wahlberg and a Shammy, and it's bad.
Yeah,
it's like a travesty. You have to see it for how bad it is, honestly.
Baby, I might watch it.
Came out like a decade ago, so I don't think I'm spoiling anything.
Yeah.
The first half of the movie starts off really interesting. Like, why are people killing themselves? It's a very interesting premise.
Yeah.
And then it's the plants.
Dude, that was during that little window where it was during the little window where Marky Mark wasn't cool, because like he's definitely. Yeah, he had Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch. Like, that was a good moment for him. And then he had, like, a few years in the early 2000s where it was not great to be Mark Wahlberg. And now it's amazing to be him again.
I do find it fascinating that your students once again bring up a morbid scenario and say it's fascinating that people are killing themselves. Ted, I feel like there might be some deep-seated issues going on in that classroom.
Piper, I'm failing these students. As a mentor, I'm failing them. This is hard, man.
All right, so we're going to move away from the morbid.
All right, Sprousey, take us out of the morbid.
We're going to stick in the fight vein.
Okay.
Leave me here. Only Mickey dies.
All right.
Apollo dies too. But
ooh, we're talking Rocky?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which Rocky fight do you want to take place in?
Which Rocky fight would I want to be a part of, Sprousey? Or like as a spectator or a participant?
As a participant. You are Rocky Balboa.
Oh, baby.
Which fight do you want to fight?
This is good. And I can tell you, Sprouse, that the other two gentlemen on the podcast will want to weigh in on this too because they're all Rocky fans.
I will also accept Creed.
No, I would accept Creed too. I think for me, dude, that first fight. The first one, 1976, at the Spectrum in Philly. He's just met Adrian. He's got so much to prove to himself, to her. Like, she's got that hot little hat on and those weird, like, weirdo hipster glasses that she wore in you know, in the, like, the pet shop scenes in that movie. I would want to fight for her, man. So I'm thinking Rocky 1 against Apollo Creed, 1,000,000-to-1 odds. Nobody thinks I can even survive two rounds, and I go the distance. I take the great Apollo Creed the distance. Still lose. I still lose the decision, but I've proven to the world and to myself that I'm not a bum. So I'm taking the first Rocky fight. So, boys, sorry to take the best one, but thankfully you've got like 8 movies left to choose from. So, Big R, you're an aficionado. You're a student of all things Rocky movie. Which fight would you want to be Rocky in?
Oh, man, that first one's hard to beat, though, man. I mean, that's,
really,
you know, because there was so much energy. There was so much passion. I mean, it was like his debut almost. You know what I mean? Like on the big, what do you call it? What do you call like the, what's the word for like the big screen in terms of fighting?
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
Like the major leagues, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. I don't know, man. I mean, I think the one that everybody gets most pumped on is obviously between him and Drago. You know what I mean? Because there was like somehow all of America's freedom was at stake in that fight. Right. I haven't figured out that one yet. But
being oppressed peoples,
like literally, Rocky loses that fight, and America is not a democracy anymore. So
we're all walking around in drab olive garments and like.
Yeah, you know. we turn. It all goes Russia and Siberia and America if he loses that fight. So yeah, there's a lot hanging on that, and I think that one's hard to beat because again, this was all mid '80s. Sylvester has a big budget for a movie, so there's a lot of sparkle and there's a lot of glitter. And
Ian, I love that dude. Yeah, I love that. James Brown is there.
And he's all super slick, like he's like fully immersed in oil for like 2 hours.
He's immersed in oil. He's hairless. That's his most like jacked and steroidal too.
Literally has peppermint essential oils just dripping off of him for like an hour.
Dude, right? And if you cut him open, like just pure steroids and growth hormone come like tumbling out of his veins.
He paved the way for all the steroid use of the 90s and 2000s. So
that's right.
He did everybody a great service.
He was a pioneer, baby. I mean, he was a pioneer. He was the first of his kind. Piper, what about you? Which Rocky movie are you, or which Rocky fight are you taking part in?
Well, you guys stole the good one. So I'm going to go with the main fight from the first Creed movie. So the one where he fights, okay. What is the guy's name? Is it Conlon?
Pretty Ricky Conlon.
Yeah. So that, I think that one just, cause it matches the original set of Rocky movies for story, for plot line, for kind of rising from nothing. He proves something. He also doesn't win. But yeah, it's, I think I would go with that one. Plus it's in Liverpool and he's fighting a guy with a cool accent. And so that's fun too.
Dude, plus Tessa Thompson meets you in the hotel the night before the fight.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of good things happening in that particular fight.
There's
sequence.
A lot of good things. Seth Orton, that comment was for you, baby. I know, man. I know.
A little bit of a Rocky opinion.
Okay.
I was talking to a few of my friends about it the other day, and it's definitely a hot take. I've never met anyone who dares this. To me, Rocky III is clearly the worst Rocky movie.
Chester.
It's not even really close to me.
Chester, you got to be careful with your Rocky opinions, because Ted will give A's to everybody except people with bad Rocky opinions.
Chester, that's the sound of you failing the class.
So give me a chance to
fail. Baby, nobody fails classes anymore. We already covered it.
Yeah, we already talked about that. I can't do that.
I can see Ted writing a letter on Union letterhead to Chester's parents saying, "This is why your son failed," and then quoting his Rocky opinion and them just being like, justifiable.
Yeah, they're like, you know what, Professor Cluck, this is hard to hear, but I agree.
Don't get me wrong, I love the Rocky movies, but there's just so many little things about Rocky III that just don't add up. Like, so he finds out when Clubber challenges him that Mick has basically been handpicking his opponents.
Yeah.
Because he basically didn't think that Rocky could beat someone like Lane because he wasn't a killer like that. And I'm thinking to myself, he literally went the distance with Apollo Creed, who's basically considered the greatest fighter of all time in that universe, and then later beats him in the next fight, and you feel the need to go handpick his opponents because you don't think he's that good?
Chester, can I speak to that momentarily?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, Professor.
That was... Yeah, I'm going to bloviate. I'm taking my glasses off and gesturing dramatically with them.
Standing on the table, staring into the middle distance. Here we go.
That's right. Chester, what was happening in that scene was that Mick was just caring for his fighter. He was trying to protect his friend, right? And he knew that fighting, boxing is a hurt business, and he wanted to navigate his fighter through that with his you know, little pain and suffering as possible. So I think it actually, rather than making, you know, for this kind of inauthentic Rocky experience, I think it adds like layers and nuance to Mick's character where you see that he really does care for his guy. Yeah. You know, he's not just in it for a payday.
Yeah, that's fair. But if you're the heavyweight champion, aren't you required to fight the top challenger once or twice a year?
Dude, right. So that's really the conflict that drives Rocky III, is this whole, like, Rocky has sort of gotten complacent, right? I mean, he's got his Ferraris, he's got his huge house, he's got the statue there in front of the art museum. I think he even drives one of his cars angrily, which is a great Rocky montage thing. Rocky gets in a car and begins, like, you know, slamming the stick shift into gear and just driving around angrily through the streets of Philly. But yeah, that fight, it was really about, like, do I really have what it takes to fight everybody? You know, can I take on all challengers as is befitting of a champion? And I think the thing I love about Rocky III, and Ron, you weigh in on this one because I know you like the movie.
Baby, hold on. I got something to tell you about that.
Yeah, lay it on me, baby.
I've never seen Rocky III before.
Oh,
he's really upset now.
Ron Martin. Wow. No, Rocky III is great, baby, because are you familiar with Mr. T from the 80s?
You know what? I probably need you to refresh my memory. Okay. Was he the guy from... I'm joking. Of course I know who Mr. T was.
Oh, okay, good, baby. Because I was ready. I was ready to refresh.
I mean, are you accusing me of never having seen the A-Team?
Yeah, never having, like, been alive in the 1980s. So, of course, you've seen the A-Team. And
but I never saw Rocky III, and I don't know why I didn't. It almost seemed like I couldn't take it serious enough because it was Mr. T. So for some reason, I've just never seen it. So there's still, like, it's kind of like Pipe having never seen Lost. Yeah. So you should be like real envious of me right now, knowing that there's a Rocky movie I've never seen.
Dude, yeah. So the great thing about Rocky III is Mr. T's character, you know, he's really ahead of his time in that he, like, you know, he goes into the race thing a little bit and he calls out like,
oh, does.
Yeah. He calls out Rocky at his big press conference to unveil the statue.
Yeah.
And he plays the race card a little bit and he gets real aggressive with Adrian, with Rocky's wife. And that like flips the switch for Rocky.
Oh, baby. I'm watching it tonight.
Watch it tonight. Text me throughout. Just let me know what you're thinking about it. But
so it was way ahead of its time, man. Just dealing with issues that we're all dealing with today.
Dude, right.
I mean, really, all we need to do is go back and watch Rocky 3 and all of our questions are going to be answered.
It tackled the tough issues already.
All of our dilemmas solved.
I haven't gotten to my real blasphemy when it comes to that movie.
Okay, Chester, lay it on us.
So I love Mr. T. I love him in A-Team, and I love uh-huh. who he is.
Just as a person. You know what? I love his heart. He's a lovely man.
Yeah. Yeah. He is by far the worst fighter that Rocky fights in the entire series.
Mm.
I mean, I think that's completely fair. He has no jab.
Of course you think it's fair. It's your opinion. That's how opinions work.
Of course you think it's fair. It's your opinion.
But he's probably the worst fighter he fights in the entire series. He has no jab. Rocky beats him more easily in the second fight than he beats anybody else in the entire mm-hmm. series. Beats him in 3 rounds.
Mm-hmm. He's like a 30-minute training.
Yeah, it was a good training montage.
It probably has the best training montage.
I mean, it sets the redemption arc for like the next
except for the homoerotic frolicking in the surf. That was a little different, but yeah, Adrian was nearby. She was watching.
Baby, what's like the big song in Rocky 3?
Eye of the Tiger, the big one.
That's Rocky 3?
That's Rocky 3.
Hey, by the way, we're Chester, you have quite an accent there, brother. Where are you coming from?
Dude, from the South.
Chester's from the South. He's got an incredible deep voice, man.
I mean, that's pretty vague. Where's the South?
He's from Memphis. We're going to start a podcast in which we just bring in random stuff for Chester to read on the air. So he's going to read like owner's manuals for toasters and Walt Whitman poetry and whatever we can get our hands on.
No Rocky takes. Not to out anybody's identity, but what is Chester's last name? Because if your first name is Chester and you have a voice like that, a last name could really complete this whole image. Yeah.
Chester Bennington.
His last name is Chester. His first name's Nathan.
Ah, okay.
Which I don't think I've ever called him Nathan in the history of our knowing each other. Not one time.
What's your middle name?
What's your middle name, Chester?
I'm Matthew.
Matthew. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
Nate.
All right.
Yeah. I don't know. Chester just felt it felt right. You know, felt
yeah,
right
that,
ask,
that
ask Chester what
was.
His give him the little thing we did, baby, with the whole like what would his like you know theological name be or however.
Dude, this
we did
is good because he's like a Bible double major. Yeah, yeah. So, all right. So this is a game we played on the air a couple of weeks ago where you take the name of the first street that you lived on, plus the name of the theology book that's like closest to you in your office or your dorm room, and then add your last name.
Not the name of the book, the name of the last name of the author of the book.
Yeah, the last name of the author who wrote the book. So, like, my theologian name was Greenwood Grudem Cluck, because I had a Wayne Grudem book, like, somewhere in my office. So, Greenwood Grudem Cluck.
Von Hall Bonhoeffer Chester.
Whoa! Can you say that again?
Von Hall Bonhoeffer Chester.
Yeah, that's huge.
Man,
it's
that's strong.
Huge.
I was Elliot Bonhoeffer Piper, so I appreciate that.
Epic.
The money thing about Chester's was that it's got the Von in the first name, which has like kind of Dutch connotations for the Reformed world. So I feel like they would be all over that.
Swooning.
Dude, Chester would get a book deal just for he'll probably get a book deal from this program. You
Chester,
know?
Can you read my next audiobook?
Sure. What's it going to be about?
What difference does that make? You're going to get paid.
Yeah. Oh, he's all of a sudden got discriminating taste. Well, you know, I'm not going to read certain things, you know.
I have strong incorrect opinions about Rocky, but I'm going to be very discerning about which audiobooks I read.
Dude, my agent just signed him. Andrew Wolgamuth just sent him a contract
just,
while we've been
you
talking.
Just have your people talk to my people.
There we go. We're making deals. People. He's got people. Everybody's got people. Oh, that's good. Yeah, he's got his parents. These are good, you guys. These are challenging questions. What else do we have? Anything Rocky related, non-Rocky related, death related?
I was thinking movie related.
Yeah, late on. So
someone wants to understand your whole persona that you have. What movie do you give them to make them understand?
Seth Horton, great question. That's why Seth is our sports editor.
I want to hear Ronnie. So, I want to hear Ronnie on this one. I feel like he's actually thought about this prior. Just that that seems likely.
So one movie that kind of encapsulates your persona, what are you giving people? This is a great question. Ron, go.
Pipe, I've literally never thought of this like one second of my life.
You know, you're just adding to my suspicion that you're not telling the truth, Ron.
It's amazing how little these dudes know me. It's unbelievable after all these years.
All these years of podcasting, being in the entertainment business
all
together.
All these years of podcasting.
Maybe all the travel, all the money.
All these years of
The decadence.
Exactly. You know, I don't know. I mean, I could list off a Terry Malick film if I wanted to be pretentious. And Terry, by the way, Terry is a lovely man.
Yeah, that's right.
Pipe, you go, man. You think about these things.
Let me think. One movie? Okay. I aspire to be almost any character that Robert Duvall plays.
Wow.
So, like, the movie that popped in. So, if you've seen the movie Secondhand Lions, he and Michael Caine play brothers. And they live out in this weird old house, and he's just like this crusty, sarcastic old man who then has to raise this sort of wussy little boy who gets dropped off. I think it's their nephew. So that's the premise of the movie. But he's just – Robert Duvall is what I would like to be when I'm like 70. So
baby, that's what you're like now. You're already a crusty old man.
Right, but you can't really get away with it very well when you're in your
30s. That's true.
People frown upon you like yelling at them and generally being a jerk.
Exactly. I like that one. That's strong, Piper. Ron, have you thought of one yet?
Well, like just like an actor that I wish I was?
No.
Like
a movie.
Either the movie can describe you or like a character from a movie who sums you up.
Oh, dude. Go ahead, Big T. I have no clue. I don't know.
Baby, wow. You're really bristling. You're really pushing back against this topic. This is fascinating.
Dude, I just don't.
Are you in Enneagram 4, Ron?
Of course.
Of course he is.
Of course you are.
So yeah, you're not going to put me in a box.
You will never, ever label yourself, will you?
Dude, I would label myself literally. My New Year's resolution is to sell out to such a degree with this podcast that everything I'm wearing is labeled. You know?
Labeled Happy Rant.
Exactly. So sponsors, if you're out there, hit us up. I think for me, it's a couple. So one... Well, one is Friday Night Lights, the movie Friday Night Lights. I think if I had to give somebody a movie that sort of spanned all the eras of my life that I've lived up to this point, either as a coach or a player or just a person around the game, it would be Friday Night Lights. Like, that one is so small town, so, like, you know, deep dive into football, really beautifully done. So that's one. I think probably any Cameron Crowe movie. So Jerry Maguire, Almost Famous, Elizabethtown. These movies all have great soundtracks. They all have really like pretty deeply flawed like male lead characters, like guys who are kind of screwed up, but they're ultimately kind of like on this journey of redeeming themselves. So I can definitely relate to all those characters. They all have really strong female characters too. So I think. Yeah, one of the tenets of the Cameron Crowe movie, whether it's, you know, the kid's mom in Almost Famous or the, you know, the wives and girlfriends in Jerry Maguire, just strong ladies. So I feel like KK would slide into one of those roles pretty easily. So I'm going Cameron Crowe or Friday Night Lights for me. Seth Horton, what about you? Since you asked the question, what movie would it be for you?
That's a tough one. And that I've never in my life thought about this for myself.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be tough. No one in here knows me, so I can't look to anyone for help for this.
Yeah.
That also means you can say whatever you want, and we have to believe you.
Honestly, I think I'm going to go with the Ocean's movies.
Dude, there you go. Okay. Oh, I like that, Seth Horton. Suave, debonair. Like, yeah, you're a bad guy, but you're really a good guy. I love it. Like, those movies, they do a masterful job of getting us to love people who are just stealing, like, billions of dollars, you know? doing very criminal things, but in a very charming way.
I'm an easy guy to root for.
Yeah.
So like, even when I'm doing the wrong thing, people want me to succeed. So.
Yeah. Boys, let me lay a question on you that has come up a couple of times here in our classroom.
Ronnie had to Irish goodbye, so he just had to peace out. I guess another meeting came up or something in his busy Ashland life. So it's just me. So you can lay a question on me.
Dude, he's done. Do you think he got offended?
No, he texted a while ago and said he has to bounce in 5 minutes. I think he had something else come up.
All right. No, that's totally fine. So the question, Piper, and I feel like we may see eye to eye on this one. So I always make a huge mistake with almost all of my classes in that I let them in too deeply to my life and I tell them too many honest things. And in the past, I've told them that from time to time, I'll pick a nemesis on campus and just somebody to kind of hate from afar for kind of no good reason. But we ascertained that my nemesis always, there are always people who are better than me, like at certain things, like whether it's just being better looking or being younger, just being a person who's like better. And so I've always had these nemeses, most of whom I end up like getting coffee with at the end of the year. And I find out that they're great dudes. And then I don't have them as a nemesis anymore. But my question to you, Piper, is have you ever had a nemesis and why? Like, how did you choose the nem?
Oh, absolutely. There's a certain persona that is always my nemesis.
Yeah. What is that persona? Describe.
See if I can articulate it. They're sort of obnoxiously confident.
Yep.
They're usually kind of aggressively outgoing.
Yep.
You know, in the type who's like, they see you in the hallway at work for the first time and they're like, "Hey, bro, we haven't met." And I'm like, you know, there's a good reason for that. So that, you know, they usually dress in such a way that you can tell. I mean, it is a very curated look. It's not always the same look, but you can tell they're trying to look like something. It's a particular fashion aura that they're putting off. They are. Let me see. Let's see what else. I usually don't get to know them well enough to know, but from afar, I'm guessing that they are always discovering new music, and they love very arty films. They love the Enneagram, and they love very feely. They love very feely things. So, or at least they purport to love them because that is the trendy thing to do. So that is the aura, and it's been like that since I was like 14.
Yeah.
So it was. It's been the same kind of person for as long as I can remember.
Do you have a nem currently?
I do. I don't know his name yet because he tried to introduce himself, and then the elevator door closed. So I don't know who he is, but I know that I work with him, and I think I think that's safe to say because there's like 1,000 employees where I work, and he likely doesn't listen to this because he likes feely things.
That's good. He's busy listening to Enneagram podcasts, so. He would never get around to this. I want to open it up to a couple people in the room. Tam, have you ever had a nemesis?
I don't know.
No?
I don't know. Like, I don't think you have.
Like a rival? Yeah, somebody that you've kind of decided that you don't like the look of or whatever from afar.
No.
No?
Because if I ever do have some sort of negative feeling, I have to get to know them so that it goes away.
Oh. Wow. So you're basically saying you're a better person than Piper and myself.
Oh, that sounds like your next nemesis, yeah. Ted. She's
no,
better than
no,
you.
No, no, no. Of course not.
No. No, I get what you're saying.
You know what I mean? Because then I'm like, okay, there's no reason for this, so I have to really, you know, test it out. But also what I saw somewhere is that a rival actually only brings about an insecurities in yourself.
Oh, for sure. That's what it's all about.
That's it.
Nothing I mean, it's all based
them.
In my insecurities.
See, right. I'm under the impression that rivals bring out the best in you.
They can. Often I don't let that happen. It just I keep it focused on the worst and on the negative aspects of myself. But Seth Horton, any nemeses in your life?
Currently no, but throughout my life it's usually sports related.
Okay.
Even I would say probably right now it's usually NBA players.
Okay.
So
Piper is conversant in the NBA. So who are some of your current NBA nemeses?
So Brandon Ingram, for instance,
okay,
who it's just one of those things like everyone thought he was going to be great when he was drafted, and mm-hmm. I just didn't want him to be. Mm-hmm. And so I've been rooting for his downfall.
You're a Celtics fan. That, you should be happy with him right now.
Exactly.
I didn't know anybody had any feelings about Brandon Ingram.
He's just, Seth is...
We don't.
Kelly Oubre. I also despise Kelly Oubre.
Again, like neither of those guys do anything to elicit feelings. They're just sort of nothings when it comes to basketball.
Like Kelly Olynyk.
Yeah, and I love Kelly Olynyk, which is why I hate him.
Piper, I think you're forgetting something really fundamental about college, and I'm sure it was true for you and me when we were in college, is that you have the time to like really care about the NBA at that level. You know what I mean? It's a magical time of life because you do. You've got the time and the space to care like that. And for me, like, I miss caring at that level. You know what I mean? I miss what that felt like.
Yeah,
so.
this is basically me being jealous is what this
yeah.
is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's us being jealous. Well, we've got a few minutes left. Time for maybe one or two more questions. Anybody else have anything to lay on us?
I have a question.
Yeah.
It's not as exciting.
Well, Elise, don't talk like that.
So what is the premise of a...
Ooh, that's a great question. Premise of a book, Piper, that you've always wanted to write. No, they're all great. If you're on a desert island and you're about to die. No.
What book would I write in a plane crash? Okay.
Yeah. Besides a book about fighting on the island, besides that memoir, which would be bananas. So yeah, book you've always wanted to write. That you haven't had the time or the resources to write. What would you say?
I have been, let's see, that's a good question. I have been trying to figure out what it would look like to write a novel. That's not a premise. That's just a super broad genre. But trying to figure out the premise of a novel that would be worth writing. And that's so maybe I should crowdsource this with the students, because the novels I love most are the ones that seem like they would be the hardest to write, because they're not like plot oriented. You know, I don't feel like it would be that hard to write, say, like what John Grisham does.
Sure.
That, I don't know if I could write it like he does, clearly, but those are not character driven. They're all plot devices, and they have like a context and a setting, and it's plot devices, and they're pretty predictable.
Sure.
Whereas you read like, I don't know, David James Duncan's The Brothers K, or Leif Anger's books, or I don't know, John Steinbeck, or any of the books that are kind of deeply human, and I go, I have zero idea how to write humans the way that guy writes humans. So that's the premise. The problem is, since it's all built on just sort of humanity, there's not a plot that I have in mind, like, oh, it should be a story about X. It's much more the complexity of, I want to write people as well as they can be written, and that's, I don't even know where to begin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you've begun in a sense by wanting to do that, but also by, you know, by reading novels over the years that have done that well. So, you know, I think that's further along than a lot of people get on that journey. But,
I might try it someday. It's just, I don't get writer's block when I'm writing nonfiction. That just doesn't exist in my world. But when writing fiction, I feel like fiction just is a writing block for me. Like, that is writer's block in a nutshell. Oh, writing a story. Yep, there's writer's block.
Yeah, it can be, man. It can be really challenging. Dude, I tell you, there aren't a lot of books that I have wanted to write that I haven't written, you know, which is on one level a great thing, but on another level, like, I'm kind of in that I don't know where to go from here moment where I'm not even sure I want to write books anymore. But I'm also not sure what I would do if I didn't write books. So
what about a screenplay? What about a screenplay you would want to write?
I mean, there are definitely examples of those, I think, but I don't know if you're like this, Piper, if you're into this like level of grizzled old manness, but I see books now and book contracts as just like paying for things that are going to go wrong around the house. Like, like this new ghostwriting project that I'm doing, like, I'm viewing it largely as like my way of dealing with some like window issues on the front of the house. And I'm like, man, I have reached jaded, grizzled old manness, because the romance is gone, you know, and I want I want the romance to come back. You know, I guess to answer Elise's question.
I mean, if you're looking for romance and writing, ghostwriting is not the way to go about it, Ted.
Dude, no, it isn't. But it's a good. There's a good buck in that racket. You
know
what
true.
I mean? I mean,
yeah. No, that's yeah, it's a yeah. good hustle, but not.
It is a good hustle, and you know, I guess my view on it is I gotta say yes while the phone is still ringing. But yeah, I guess to answer her question, I would want to do whatever project would like bring the romantic feelings back. You know, whatever prospect or whatever project would like really get me into that place where I'm thinking about the book all the time. I'm loving the characters.
Do you think any author who's written multiple books still feels that? Or is it always like, is there always just sort of a like, this is the work now mentality? And I don't mean that in a yeah. like, I think of work as a good thing. So that's not a negative statement. I feel like once you're past, you know, maybe book two, it's like being in a long-term relationship. You get out of the newness stage and then you can still be in a really good place, but it's not like new and exciting all the time. You know what I mean? I feel like writing is a little bit like that.
No, I totally agree. And I think, you know, part of the thing with a career like that is that it is sexy. You know, it's not like digging ditches or whatever. There's the sense of like people are interested in it and it's fun and it's fun to talk about at parties and all that stuff. But yeah, all that is definitely gone. I still do enjoy the act of making sentences. Like I really like to write a good sentence. I like to write a story and tell one, but yeah, I guess to answer your question, I want to believe that even an older writer who's done a lot of books can get that feeling back at some point for a certain project, you know? Cause if the answer is no, then I guess I can be thankful for having had that feeling before. And I can be thankful that like the phone is still ringing, but I can kind of stop dreaming about feeling a certain way. You know what I mean?
I kind of wonder if some of the, when you get into publishing as work or for money, I think that almost is inherently at odds with writing for just sort of the joy or the romance of it.
Yeah.
And so I think for somebody like you or for like me to get that back, it almost has to just be something that it's like a passion project that we would be okay if it wasn't published someday. Or,
sure.
It might never be because it's just the thing that we keep coming back to. Because it's, when I think about publishing, my mind immediately goes to like what would work, you know, what are publishers looking for? And you just immediately leave out a ton of creative work that could be done because it just won't work in the publishing world.
Dude, right. You start thinking about what would work. You start thinking about who do I have to involve to make this happen? And, you know, the kind of joyfulness and the romance kind of goes down exponentially with each person that you add to a project, and you know, whether it's editors or publicity people or whatever. So yeah, man, I totally agree. I think it would be something that I just kind of work at, passion projects. You know, the movie Silverdome is like that. You know, that was very much a like just came from the heart, never figured it would go anywhere thing that you know, we're trying to bring it out into the light of day. But I think the best stories and the most nourishing ones, you know, soul wise are the ones that are the most personal, that the ones that you have to write, whether there's going to be a book deal or a movie deal or anything on the other end. And yeah, after you've done that a few times, like I hope that comes back. You know, I just hope like that personal feeling comes back at some point. But yeah, really good question.
That is a good question.
Yeah, that was a great one for sure. Piper, do we need to wrap this program? We've been going almost an hour.
I mean, I'm happy to stay on as long as people have questions. I'm not in a rush to go anywhere.
Do we have one more, frivolous or serious? Yeah, ask one off of hers for sure.
Do you feel like that's kind of like your natural of being what you actually want prior to invest? Like passion that you're putting the work rather than what you need or you people
yeah.
want you to do?
Yeah, so this is something we talked about off the air pipe with the class, how I think the media and like movies and TV, they condition us.
Ted, could you repeat the question? It was a little fuzzy.
Yeah, the question was, you know, is passion like your undergirding sort of metric for whether or not to do a project?
Mm-hmm.
And something we talked about off the air was how the media makes you know, single-minded devotion to the art out as like the sexiest thing. So like Jackson Pollock's in a room slinging paint against a canvas and his super hot wife comes in and says like, you know, I've cooked you a 5-star meal and then I'm going to drag you into bed. And he's just like, no, you know, get out. Like I'm devoted to the work. And, you know, so that's viewed as like the best thing, you know, the most ideal thing is the single-minded, passionate devotion to the work. But in reality, when you're a husband and a dad, like, you know, homeowner, and I mean, all these very much of the earth kinds of problems of how am I going to pay my bills and what needs to be fixed around the house, like projects take on a real utilitarian kind of bent where you're like, yeah, in a perfect world, I would really, really want to tell this story. But in the actual world, I kind of want to tell the story, but I really need $10,000. So I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. You know what I mean?
Right.
Has that been your experience?
Yeah, I think it's, it is a myth of privilege that you get to do what you are most passionate about and make a living doing it. If that happens, you are in an exceptionally privileged position. And I don't mean that privilege is a negative thing there. I just mean it's rare. Like that's a thing that only happens for some people, which means that you need to, like, you have to carve out room for the passion. It's what people have called hobbies in the past. Those are the things that, yeah, that you're excited about, but you also have another job. And I know that there, like, there's a generational mindset that says we have a right to do what we are passionate about and get paid for it.
Yeah.
And reality and that mindset just don't always match up very well. I would love to just do stuff that I'm excited about and have somebody hand me a paycheck for it. But even in that realm, like there's still just a grind and a hustle to it in terms of, I mean, if you want to be a writer for a living, what you're forgetting is the amount of time you have to spend pitching the stuff that you write, the amount of time you have to spend negotiating, the amount of time you have to spend chasing down people who didn't pay you on time. And I mean, that's just writing. The same is true for any sort of freelance work. And so I don't think passion should be the driving force in decision making on the work that we do. And once you're responsible for other people, so I have kids, Ted has a family, the metric changes dramatically because now your responsibility is for those who need you. If you're single and unattached and have nobody who is responsible, like you're not responsible for anybody, you probably have more freedom to take risks. And so it just becomes this equation of like what is best for the responsibilities that I have as an adult. And in any context, like I've always tried to carve out room for the things I'm passionate about, but it ebbs and flows. Like it's been 2 years since I've written a book. I'm just getting into one now because the last 2 years have just not been conducive to passion projects. But now I can do that a little bit more. And so I think there's just that ebb and flow to it. I don't know if that really helps answer the question. I hope it does.
No, it does. And I think that's something that as college professors, we should be a little more like explicit about with our students. You know, everything around here is so ideological and kind of pie in the sky that, you know, I think we do our kids a disservice if we don't tell them what it's actually like to make a living. And part of that is finding the projects that bring in the most passion, but are the most practical. And if I can make those two circles overlap in a project, then I've got a good one. And if the circles don't touch at all, it's probably not a project that I should do. So if I feel 0% passion for it, I should probably step away from it.
Well, there's also a difference between passion and purpose. Like if the work you're doing is not something that you're elated about, but it has a good purpose or it feeds the good purpose of your life. So you're doing mundane work, but it is providing for a more meaningful purpose. Then that's not an insignificant thing. And so I think it's more helpful to think about what is the purpose of what I'm doing as opposed to how passionate am I feeling, because passion in that way, it ebbs and flows, and there can be something you invest deeply in that you stop feeling passionate about. That doesn't mean it stopped having a good purpose. That means your feelings changed, and that feelings are just fickle things. So I try to measure things more by purpose than passion in terms of actual decision making.
Yeah, that's a good word, Pipe. And that, I mean, that holds true for a marriage or, you know, a job commitment or any kind of commitment that we make. So that's a good note to end on, my friend. This has been a lot of fun. It was fun for the 20 minutes that we had Ron in the studio with us. And and thanks to my students again for making this great and bringing great death-related and plane crash-related questions to the table. It's always good to be challenged on those levels.
I appreciated the spectrum of questions ranging from desert islands to life's purpose. So that was
Rocky
that
3.
Was enjoyable. Yes, can't leave out Rocky.
About Rocky 3. So, Piper, we have done what we always do on this program. We have wandered to and fro throughout these topics. And until next time, Rachel the Held Evans.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Hello, I'm Adam Comer.
And I'm Ryan Chittister.
And we are the host of Life After Addiction podcast. What we believe is that addiction is not a surprise to God.
That's right. We discuss addiction from a biblical worldview and how true freedom comes through a personal relationship with Jesus Christ.
Absolute freedom from addiction, the secular worldview of once an addict, always an addict, is just not true. If you or someone you love struggles with addiction, subscribe to Life After Addiction at lifeaudio.com.